Thanks, Peter. Our next speaker is Gary Lewis. Welcome, Gary.
Okay, thanks. I'd like to thank the board for allowing me to say something. And it's a rather controversial subject, but I'll start with a little bit of personal information. My name is Gary Lewis. I work as a mechanical designer at the as a contractor to Syncrude, and I work out of the Aurora plant site. I'm also a local member and sometimes referred to as a local correspondent for Environmentalists for Nuclear Power. I'm an author of a paper that was published and posted on the internet on the ecolo.org website, which is Environmentalists for Nuclear Power. The title of the paper is referred to as Oil Sands Kyoto and the Nuclear Option. I'd like to briefly talk about the paper and just give you the table of contents, but what I'd like to do is go beyond the paper slightly and talk about things that are outside the paper. I believe you have one copy, but I can supply the board with as many copies as you like. The table of contents, of course, is the natural gas issue, the increased oil production, which is possible with nuclear power, the capping of the natural gas wells, the issue of the Mackenzie Valley pipeline, First Nations concern, environmentalist issues, that is, the people on the environmental side, such as thoughts that from the Sierra Club, for example, Greenpeace, and Friends of the Earth. The cost, the Canadian energy, there's a section here on the hydrogen economy, and there's an awful lot of talk about that lately. Hydrogen from nuclear, the value-added economy, and I'm sure the people at the Chamber of Commerce would be interested in that. And of course, it's the big issue of Kyoto. I briefly talked about the journey and nuclear safety and waste. Also, I talk about the possibility of using coal as an alternative and my reasons for rejecting coal as an alternative for energy source. What I'd like to do here is talk about the extreme issue on regarding natural gas supplies in Canada. I've got a graph here that was produced from British Petroleum's Statistical World Review, and I list a whole bunch of countries here. And what I've done here was I put a table together on all of the countries that have the greatest amount of years of supply of natural gas left. The one in first place here is Qatar. It has 656 years of natural gas supply left. Second is Azerbaijan with 331. Iran is 324, etc. So this is from BP's stats, right? So I'll go through the countries here. I mentioned the top three. The following are Nigeria, Libya, Kuwait, Kazakhstan, Venezuela, United Arab Emirates, Bolivia, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Burma, Syria, Australia, Egypt, Ukraine, Oman, Vietnam, Algeria, China, and it goes all the way through. In the 42nd spot is the United States of America, Bahrain, and Denmark, and second to last place is Canada. And according to, I guess, the BP stats, it's 9.3 years of natural gas left. The one in last place is the United Kingdom, and they'll be importing natural gas through liquefied natural gas terminals fairly soon. The figure of 9.3 years of natural gas left for Canada is confirmed or at least corroborated by another study. And this is by a study, of course, some of you may have already know this study, and that was done by the Canadian Energy Research Institute, and it was published in 2003. And there they talk about the amount of years of supply that's left, and they come up with a figure of reserve production ratio of 8.3 years, so theirs is actually less. So I can leave you this, and it's of course downloadable from the internet. What I'd like to do here is talk about extreme importance that natural gas has to not only the Canadian market, but to the whole North American market regarding certain industries that are presently hurting a great deal. Some of them, for example, has to do with the issue of fertilizer. We've talked about fertilizer before, which is fascinating. To give you an idea, one can make the argument that fertilizer producers have to be just more efficient. However, the Canadian producers shell out more than $8 per unit outside of North America. That figure is as low as $1. How does one compete with the competitors on the global stage with cheaper costs? The chief executive officer of fertilizer company in Saskatchewan, SAFCO, his name is Fred Gill. He made the following statement. We have had three major challenges, the first being natural gas, the second being natural gas, and the third being natural gas. The price of natural gas has reached stratospheric levels. Now, the Minister of Energy, I think Greg Nolshan had mentioned that the prosperity of Alberta ripples right across the country. But there's a real downside to that, because you probably know natural gas is being consumed at a rate of 1 billion cubic feet per day. And that's likely to increase. Now, that 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas per day could be converted to none other than ammonia. And that ammonia, of course, is used for the production of a fertilizer. Of course, the people at Syncrude know that ammonia is also combined with the flue gas desulfurization unit, which in turn produces another fertilizer. What's fascinating about this is that, especially with the whole issue of global warming, one realizes that natural gas can be a carbon dioxide fixing mechanism, not a carbon dioxide source. That is to say, if we take a lot of the natural gas and send it to the south, and they can displace huge amounts of carbon dioxide as a result of displacing carbon dioxide from coal-fired plants, then carbon dioxide produced from natural gas is a whole lot better, because of the fact that it produces half of the amount of CO2 compared to coal. But if you go one step further and convert it to ammonia, then that can, in fact, kickstart the whole hydrogen economy, because there's no carbon in ammonia. It's also fascinating, too, is that the Syncrude technology can be exported to any number of industries that produce high quantities of sulfur dioxide. So we end up having cleaner air as a result of taking sulfur dioxide out of the air, and thereby have a lot less greenhouse gases because of having acid rain. Because sulfur dioxide combines with water to produce a mild form of sulfuric acid. What's fascinating here is that the end product is being ammonium sulfate. That in turn can be used for fertilizer, and then it becomes a carbon sink, so to speak. It actually takes carbon dioxide out of the air. What really worries me is that Saskatchewan and in certain places in Alberta, or excuse me, in BC, they have companies are hurting so much that some of them are actually gone out of business. The chief executive officer of Mosaic said in an interview in July of this year that 17 or so natural gas fired plants went out of business in the southern United States as a result of high natural gas prices. That is, they take the natural gas and produce ammonia with it. And so Americans may be dependent upon oil from the Middle East, for example, but in the future, as there may be a great dependency on Middle Eastern natural gas. Natural gas is also used in other areas, one of them being methanol. In Kitsamat, British Columbia, for example, there is a company called Methanex, and they lost 127 jobs as a result of natural gas prices being far too high. What's fascinating about methanol is the amount of value added features that this particular substance has. For example, methanol can be used for synthetics, textiles, plywood, 100% recyclable plastics, household paints, adhesives, urethanes, foam cushions, for fleece clothing, packaging, beverages, household products, polyester, refrigerants, silicones, shampoos, liquid detergents, animal feed, synthetic or jet fuels additives, fungicides. So this is, there is almost, I think according to some reports, there could be a 4-to-1 added value in there. So burning 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas per day, and that's likely to increase over the next few years, it would result in economic devastation, I believe, to the Canadian Fertilizer Institute, Canadian fertilizer industry. I used to work in the Canadian potash industry in Saskatchewan, and huge amounts of natural gas is burnt as a means of producing potash. So the American farmer will end up being outraged at the fact that he can't buy potash in years to come, because even though the potash is still in the ground, there's no energy in order to run the crystallizer circuit. And therefore, our foodstuffs, or the food that we eat, will result in very high cost of living increases. As you, all you have to do is listen to the American or the radio, for example, and you can hear the Canadian farmer and his American farmer discussing the problem of high input costs. I would like to end in saying that, especially with the previous callers, I can understand their sympathy, because my ex-wife is Cree, and I live in, my hometown is in Thompson, Manitoba. I'd like to end with James Lovelock. James Lovelock, if you know, is the author of the Gaia Hypothesis, and he says that we have very little time left in order to solve the whole global warming issue. Anybody, as soon as the movie An Inconvenient Truth comes out, I'll send you on DVD, I'll send you a copy of it.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Thank you, Gary. And I was listening to your presentation, and I'm under the impression you're looking at alternative measures of energy consumption. Our production?
Yes, that's right. I can give you the survey report right here.
Yeah, that'd be great. So, it seems to me you were alluding to, and I don't know if you really hit it on the head, but you were talking about non-renewable resource alternatives, such as using something other than natural gas. So, are you promoting or talking about like a nuclear energy, nuclear reactor as an alternative to oil sands development?
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm suggesting. According to my calculations, that if for 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas per day, you could use as many as 10 nuclear reactors. There's been, certainly in the Surrey report, there's an excellent dissertation there of how it's actually cost-effective, according to the Surrey report. And that one thing that it does do is that it's fascinating. Not only does it produce electrical power, but the waste heat that's coming from the nuclear reactor can be used in order to create hot water, and that hot water can be used in the separation of oil from the sand. Right now we use, of course, large amounts of natural gas in order to do that.
Yeah, and I would probably agree with you in your opening comments. It is definitely a controversial issue, but it's worth definitely your discussion. And I just want to, I don't know if you've heard of you may have heard, and it may, and I'm not trying to say it from my perspective, but I'm just agreeing with your comment, that, but the co-founder actually of Greenpeace, and I just can't seem to remember his name.
Oh, it's Patrick Moore.
Patrick Moore.
Yeah, that's right.
He's now started a company called Green Spirit.
Yes, that's right.
Have you had any dealings with Patrick Moore's movement in towards alternative energy such as nuclear?
Yes, his story is actually very, very fascinating, in fact. In fact, Patrick now is chair of a Washington, D.C.-based company called Case Energy. He's co-chaired with a former governor of New Jersey, Christy Whitman. Now, Christy Whitman was the former Environmental Protection Agency director of the U.S. government. She was in her early days under the Bush administration. She was, well, how you put it politely, ostracized because of her insistence that greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide is affecting the climate. Because she had insisted that we have to tackle the climate change issue. She was actually welcomed quite a great deal for her or anti-CO2 stance, right? But because of her views, she was later had to resign. She decided, as being a former EPA director, got in touch with a founder of Greenpeace, that is Patrick Moore, and they just decided to promote nuclear power in the United States. And they're in the process of doing that now. And they're doing a very good job, I might add. And,
just a quick question. In your paper, you have a chapter where you talk about security. Maybe you could just summarize really, really shortly what do you see there being significant security issues?
I was looking at it more of a standpoint of environment and how I can do that. But briefly, I did have a small section in there on security. I was suggesting the concerns of possible terrorist attacks, especially in this post-9/11 world. The thought here is that Cold Lake, Alberta is only seconds away by a CF-18 fighter. So we certainly have the air cover over this. So if there's I think the likelihood of a repeat of 9/11 is slim, especially when you have a dozen or so CF-18 fighters just at the Cold Lake. I think any further questions regarding security should probably be taken up with the Department of Defense.
Thanks again, Gary.